Okay then, so I've lifted myself up in this chair so you can see me a bit better. I had complaints last week that you couldn't see me well enough. I won't keep on going up. We gave him on his head like a big hat. It's an old trick, but it often works. Okay, so spiritual life starts with integration. The beginning of the path, the start of the path, the great stage of the path is integration. Becoming whole, becoming a complete person. Not a selection of people vying for supremacy. Not one person one moment and another person another. So someone who's integrated is someone who can keep their promises, for instance. Someone who does what they say. They don't just say one thing one moment and then the next day they've changed their mind about it. Someone who can be trusted because they're integrated enough to be trusted, if you see what I mean. Someone who says if they'll meet you at such a place, they will do, and so forth. Yeah? Someone who says, I want to explore such and such a thing, and they do. So that there's enough of them behind their decisions, behind their choices, to actually live from that. And so often we find that that's not the case, don't we? We have, in certain conditions, say, when you feel inspired, you suddenly think, I want to meditate, I want to practice Buddhism, I want to be more ethical, I want to be more honest. But the next evening in the pub, you're not so sure if you get that far. The famous one is, you decide, tomorrow morning you're going to meditate, you're going to do two, and you just stay under the duvet. Yeah. So every time we notice that, a dissonance between what we know we want to do, even what we know what's in our own best interests, but what we fail to do, we're just showing that we're not yet integrated. So you see how integration must be the first stage of spiritual life. Otherwise, nothing can be resolved, nothing can be committed to, nothing can be followed through, because there's not a one person to do that. Do you see what I mean? And the main thing we need for spiritual life is to commit ourselves to it eventually, actually. We need to give ourselves to it. And we need to be integrated enough to be able to do that. Otherwise, we give ourselves to it and then we think, actually, no, I fancy snowboarding. Or I fancy mystic healing or something. You know what I mean? You'll just change your mind. Yeah? So there's no way to get round this stage. Of course, one of the issues about these stages is that they're infinite. And tonight I want to say a little bit about that, but they're infinite. So you can always become more and more integrated. And we're trying to avoid that kind of infinite regret. But we need to be integrated enough so that we can take complete responsibility for ourselves. That's the main thing with integration. So that we really are living from our own side. We're doing things because we have decided to do them and that we can follow up on them. We're not just doing things because of social pressure, because we picked up various ideas from the media and so forth, or we're just living out the sort of things our parents told us before that we were seven. An integrated person is someone who lives completely from their own side. They decide they want to meditate, and they can then actually carry on with that meditation practice even while conditions change and even whilst they're around people who don't possibly value that very much. They see the value of it, they emotionally have that experience and they live through it. Yeah? So you see that integration is an inevitable first stage of the great stages of the path. And that metaphor I'm using there is a metaphor of the journey, isn't it? It's a metaphor of the path. The spiritual path begins with integration. It begins in this way. I think that's a very valid way of putting it, but it has shortcomings as a metaphor. I mentioned this in my prequel to the seminar, so I'll go through it a little bit again. So as soon as we have this idea of a journey, a path that starts somewhere, starts with integration and ends somewhere, with enlightenment, with the Buddha himself, as soon as we do that, it's a metaphor. And it's very like our life, isn't it? Because our life does feel like a journey. It feels like a journey from birth to childhood, to youth, to old age, and so on. Yeah, it does feel like a journey. And spiritual life is the journey par excellence. I was saying last week that it's not that you choose a spiritual life, it's that your life already is one, and this is what it'll shape up like if you engage with the spiritual life you've already got. But that's just the first metaphor. So what I want to talk about tonight is, how do I want to say this? I want to talk about how we need to correct that metaphor to some degree. So I've got this metaphor of the journey, the path, but there are dangers in that metaphor. So if we think of that too literally, that our spiritual life is a journey from here to there, we could start to think, couldn't we, that enlightenment is something that we can get, that we're travelling on this journey, and eventually we get this thing called enlightenment, like getting to Tesco's or something. Except for, they give, I don't know, I can't, that's a very good metaphor. Anyway, you see what I mean? That you can start to think that it is a literal journey, that you travel, but you remain unchanged. That's one of the dangers of that metaphor. The other danger of the metaphor of the journey is that it becomes too future-focused. So you think, oh yes, I'd like to do this thing called spiritual life, because then in the future I'll be happy. Then in the future in the future I'll be a different person, and that'll be handy because I'm not very keen on the person I am just now. So you see what I mean? So you can start to think, yes, I'd like to practice spiritual life, because guess what, I'll end up to be someone else, and that'd be nice. Yeah. So it can become too future focused, too based on the idea that if I do this now, things will happen tomorrow. Jam tomorrow is the tradition, isn't it? Hardship today, jam tomorrow, yeah? And there are all kinds of problems with it. Before you know it, you've lived the spiritual life for 10 years, 20 years, and do you get jam tomorrow after all? Are you a different person? And you certainly won't be a different person, yeah? So the metaphor, like any metaphor, has got problems within it. It's a temporal metaphor. It's a metaphor to do with time, yeah? All metaphors are temporal or spatial. So this is a temporal metaphor. It's about going from here to there. By using that metaphor, I can say we do this and then we do that and then we look out for that, and then if we turn left there, we'll find this. Yeah? It's just a metaphor, folks. Yeah? And that metaphor will have these inbuilt dangers. It can be too future-orientated, therefore too one-sidedly self-willed, too strained, too concerned to get away from where we are now into a future that we want. Yeah. So Buddhism, in a way, is a kind of series of metaphors, each one correcting the one before. So the other great metaphor in Buddhism is either the lotus is probably the primary one that you see here on these backdrops, the lotus, or what I've used in my book, the metaphor I'm using in my book primarily, is the mandala. So I think this is the second great metaphor in spiritual life, is we either think of it as a path, or we think of it as a lotus, or we think of it as a path, or we think of it as a mandala. Yeah? So the lovely thing about the lotus is growing. A lotus doesn't just flick open, it has to grow out of the mud, it has to climb up into the water, it has to be a stem, and then a bud, and then gradually it changes. So that makes it very clear that your nature changes on the path. Do you see what I mean? You see how each metaphor corrects a problem or the other. It's not a path that you walk along unchanged, gathering spiritual goodies on your way. And I have met people who are like this. They start to have deep experiences, and they start to use them as a kind of badge to show how specially spiritual they are. With the metaphor of the journey, spiritual progress can become a kind of sort of refined selfishness, actually, sort of pseudo-spiritual selfishness. And I have met this, it's people who sort of like to trade on their spiritual experiences as a kind of badge of honour, even something to sort of brag about. As soon as we do that, we're actually going in the very opposite direction of spiritual life. We're getting in a bus and going the opposite direction. Yeah. So the metaphor of the lotus shows you that you yourself will change, and you will change unimaginably. So if you could imagine that bit of root in the mud, and you were to say to that root of the mud, guess what you're going to end up looking like? And the root would think, like a really, like a big root. Anyway, like a really hairy root. No, like a really deep root. And then they say, no, no, ta-da, you show a lotus. You just think, no, that's not me at all. No way. You know, that's nothing to do with me. You see what I mean? The lotus is unimaginable to the root, and yet it is in the root somehow. Enlightenment is like that to us. We simply can't imagine it. And if we were to be able to, if someone wants to say, here is the Buddha, you just think, well, he's nothing like me. I don't recognise that at all. Yeah. So what this metaphor does of the lotus is it corrects this idea that you will go along a spiritual life, accrue spiritual things, which you'll be able to tell your friends about at home, but being unchanged yourself. What this metaphor is saying, that you will become something unimaginable. And to do that, the root has to die, as it were. The root has to be left behind, is better, isn't it? So the metaphor of the lotus corrects the problem inherent in the metaphor of the journey. It shows you it's about growth, it shows you it's gradual, it shows you your change. It also tends to help us correct the idea that spiritual life is primarily future-focused. All about the future. If I do this now, jam tomorrow. The reason I'm using the mandala in my book is because actually I think this makes it still clearer. So a mandala is traditionally the ground plan of a temple. That's where it comes from. And what you, in those original ground plans of the temple, you put the Buddha figure in the middle, and then you have this temple around the Buddha figure. Actually, I think what you get with a mandala is a architectural version of a lotus, with the petals of the open lotus forming the mandala, and there you are, the central stamen in the middle. And that's what you've got as this metaphor. You've got a central point, and then you've got all the elements of spiritual life arranged around them. Yeah? And what this makes it clear is that these five great stages are also the five elements of this mandala, or the five great petals of the lotus around this central stem. Do you see what I mean? So this makes it clear that from this point of view, there's no hierarchy between the mandala, apart from the centre, isn't there? So the mandala is a spatial metaphor. It's not a temporal metaphor like the path. It's a spatial metaphor. And that's saying that we need to gradually create this mandala, this harmonious pattern, that's what it ends up being, which has spiritual, it has integration, positive emotion, spiritual death, spiritual rebirth, spiritual receptivity. And that is the mandala, and we need to do it all at the same time. Yeah? It's not a question really of doing this and then this, that's only just a way of speaking. Actually, we always need to do all the mandala at the same time. So do you see how the two metaphors correct each other? And what I'm doing in my book, the first chapter on integration is on the journey, second chapter is on the mandala. Yeah? So from this point of view, there's no hierarchy in the mandala, apart from this central stem, the central stamen, the Buddha finger at the centre of the ground plan. Yeah? And what this does is it corrects some of the problems in the first metaphor, but the first metaphor corrects the problems of the mandala or the lotus. If you're not careful, if you just have a mandala or lotus, what happens is that spiritual life becomes too present orientated. It becomes too much about just being here now, and this terrible idea of living in the moment, which isn't really a Buddhist idea. It starts to sort of fall into those kind of problems, yeah? It corrects one metaphor whilst creating new problems of itself. Yeah. So I've come to think in writing so far that the journey or the path is the primary metaphor. Once you set out on the path, you're going to bound to get things wrong. You're going to misunderstand how long it is, how fast you can go, what you need to bring with you on the way. Yeah? So the mandala comes along and corrects your misreading of the first metaphor. But you can't really start with the mandala or the lotus. You need to bring that in as a corrective. But it's an important principle that what we're trying to do is not just create step on step. We're trying to create a harmonious pattern. Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit about the mandala. So integration is an aspect of the mandala rather than the first part of a path. So what this tells you straight away is integration is something that we're going to be doing all the way through the spiritual path at ever and ever deeper levels. It's not something you leave behind. It's not something you leave behind. So even when going back to my story of the Buddha last week, even when you look at his life, I was saying that his life began with what seems to be, from what we know, and in my kind of mythic parable-like telling of the story, you start with somebody incredibly integrated, incredibly human and happy, in a very straightforward, unneurotic, unconflicted, at ease in himself kind of way. What you've got in the unenlightened Buddha, in Siddhartha, is it's a healthy, happy human being. He can think deeply, he can feel strongly, he can go out to people, he was very physically fit. He lived a healthy human life. Yeah? So I'm saying, from the point of view of the journey, that's where we need to start, being a happy, healthy human being. If we're not there now, we need to be consciously cultivating a simple, happy, healthy human state of mind, one that's not riven by splits and conflicts and polarizations and self-hatreds and so on. That needs to be there right from the onset. My experience of some of those things is that they can't ever quite be solved. In fact, sometimes they can only be solved by moving on to the next stage. But that's something perhaps I'll go on to later on. But even in terms of Siddhartha's story, I'm saying that. But actually, that's true in one way. But in another way, Siddhartha's story starts with wisdom, doesn't it? So what happens with Siddhartha, he sees old age, sickness and death, first of all. And he really sees that. He doesn't just notice it. He doesn't say, oh yes, we get old, don't we? Some dreadful sort of platitude that we easily cover reality in. Oh yes, you know, time goes by so fast and so on. He actually sees that suffering, old age, sickness and death, is already there in his life, effectively. He sees that. He sees it right the way through. In other words, he sees it with complete integration. The reason we don't see it is because we're not integrated. We see it with a little tiny bit of our cerebral cortex. We kind of tick it off, but we don't really see it right the way through to our emotional core. We merely assent to it cognitively, and that, frankly, hardly does anything at all. So Siddhartha's journey starts actually with seeing the three sights, doesn't it? Seeing it with full integration, otherwise it wouldn't have changed him. So from that point of view, you see how it starts with wisdom. And wisdom is the end of our journey. But we've just started, and we started with Siddhartha's story, not the Buddha yet, but actually we started with wisdom, really seeing the nature of reality, really seeing that suffering is inevitable in human life, that there is a massive problem with our life. And that is the problem of death, particularly. That this life of ours, the one we so want and cling to, the worst possible thing is going to happen to us. The thing we absolutely don't want to happen will happen, and we don't know when. Siddhartha's life starts with an incredible grasping of that problem, and an unwillingness ever to let that problem go. He was never, from that point, distracted from that problem. And that is our human problem. It's not a Buddhist problem, it's not a religious problem, it's not a spiritual problem. It's the problem of life. It's the problem that human beings are born with, and it's the problem that the Buddha set out to solve. So from that point of view, the Buddha's life begins with wisdom, not with integration in a sense. You see how integration precedes it in a sense, but you could also say it begins with wisdom. So already we don't know whether we're talking about wisdom here or integration. We're certainly not talking about integration for the sake of itself. You see what I mean? Sometimes I think when people talk about these things, it looks like Buddhism is just another well-being practice, wonderful though that might be. The Buddhist cause of the reason why we're trying to cultivate happiness, a happy, healthy human being, a happy state of mind, an integrated state of mind, is so that we can see our real human predicament, so we can see our human problem. Not just so we get to be happy, healthy individuals. The Buddha would, I think, find that really quite trivial. It just, I think, what's the point? I was reading about the Titanic again, and the stories from the Titanic, and he'd say, well, it's just like, you know, arranging deck chairs on the Titanic, the band on the Titanic played, I can't remember which song it was now, but they were playing this song until the last possible moment. It's just like that, hearing nice music until the lights go off. Yeah. So the Buddhist vision of integration and being happy, healthy human is so that we can really see our predicament, not so we can just make ourselves comfortable in this life. So what you've got, what that shows us, what the mandala shows us, is we need actually all of the stages at the same time. And that we're going to be deepening them all. Integration, positive emotion, spiritual death, spiritual rebirth, spiritual receptivity. We need to be deepening them all the time. And life is also like this, isn't it? I don't know whether you have this, but I have seem to have this more and more, a sense that everything is always here. This idea that life is a journey is... it's not quite like that, is it? When you look at your life more deeply, when I look at my life more deeply, everything is already here. So even as I'm sitting here talking to you about integration, there's my whole life here. There's my childhood here. There's everything that's happened to me here. It colours how I speak, colours the words I use. All my life is here, just as all your life is here. You haven't really left your childhood behind, like something that happened in the past and it doesn't affect you now. And you never will leave it behind in that sense. You might grow from it, but you won't. It won't be anything that is not you anymore. Your past is here. Your future, in a sense, is here. And as I talked to you just now, I can't really think of, okay, I just need to integrate myself. I'll get to you later. Because you have this sort of propensity to just be here now, don't you? You can't wait for me to do the integration bit and then I'll get on to you. And that's what we're always in that position, aren't we? There's always this self-sense of looking within ourselves, deepening ourselves. But every time we do that, there's always surrounded by other people. And we're always surrounded by the natural world. Everything is here just now, isn't it? There are other people, there's thinking, there's feeling, there's listening, there's being here just now. Where's this journey after all? There is just this being here just now. Our whole life is here just now. And if we're to gain insight, if we're to become a Buddha, here's the moment. There's never going to be a future moment where this is happening, is there? All that's just an idea. So here it is just now. This is our chance just now to see things as they really are. There's never going to be a future when we do that. So the mandala makes that aspect of life really clear, doesn't it? That here we are in our life just now. And our task is to integrate ourselves just now, to become emotionally positive, to die to ourselves in the best sense, to be spiritually reborn, and to be spiritually receptive. And we need to do all of those things just now. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, here we are, aren't we? It's me. Here we are. So easy, isn't it, to sort of have this, even in our life, my day is like this journey. So I have this and this and this, and then this, and then I go and do this, and then I go to bed. And if we're not careful, we're living our life just like we're sort of reeling ourselves in on a bit of rope. You know, there's morning and there's bedtime, and we're just going through our day, going through it, you know, a little winch, rocking slightly, but not really attending to here we are just now. There isn't really a night that we're going to. There's just here we are just now. And any deepening experience is going to be a deepening into here we are just now. Without this present moment thing, which I'm not very keen on, as we all know, because it doesn't do justice to here we are just now, because the present moment isn't here just now. There's just this mysterious just now, which includes everything that's happened, and strangely has within it the potentiality for everything that could happen. You can make a decision now that changes your whole life, couldn't you? In this sort of moment. And looking back on it, you suddenly think, gosh, that was a really important moment in my life. So I was thinking just the other day how coming here for the first time utterly changed my life. Not in a spooky, I became a different person kind of way, but changed the whole course of my life. I came here when I was 24 into this room. I was at art school, cycled here from my squat in Brixton, which was like living in an open plan fridge. and the bathroom seemed to be the freezer box. anyway, you don't need to, that's how we live there. And I came along. I remember having this sort of strange sense of foreboding coming here. I had a weird sense that if I came, my life would never be the same. And I remember putting it off. And I remember the journey here was snowing. And I got here, I always got here late. I used to have to do a sort of like a forward roll into the shrine room. And then I'd sort of fall asleep in the meditation. But what happened, I came here and somebody sitting on the other side of the shrine, he just taught the mindfulness of breathing practice. He just introduced it. Halfway through introducing it, I just knew I was a Buddhist. I knew that, and by that I mean, it was like someone saying, see your life you've had, that intimate life you've had, that you've never been able to quite describe to other people, you've never been able to quite fathom. Here's what it's been about. Here's what it's been about. And I just thought, I just knew, oh, that's what my life's been about. That's what my life's been about. And so that's what my life is about. So there's no question of it not being about that, because that's what my life's been about. And somehow that's what I got from being taught even the mindfulness of breathing. Here's your life. You know what you've been doing, sort of crashing around and at times causing yourself suffering and causing other people, you know, that silliness you did the other day. This is what you were trying to do all that time. You didn't know it, but this is what you were trying to do. You know when you were a child and you couldn't stand it in some way. Well, this is why, because this is what your life was trying to be about. Yeah? So it changed my life. I didn't become a different person. Didn't suddenly it was spiritual. It was just that I knew what my life was about. In that moment then, 26 years ago, I changed my life. And that can happen if you're open enough, if you're receptive enough. Sometimes it happens when you least expect it and you don't notice it for years. You suddenly think, that's interesting, I'm still here. That must have been to do with that experience. Yeah? Sometimes, of course, it's much more gradual. So here we are in just now, and part of what we're doing, all that we're focusing on in this just now, is the need to be integrated just now. Actually, there's wisdom here just now if we want to be open to it. If I can be in touch with it with myself, I could change just now, just as you could just now. And one of the reasons I teach is to teach myself, is to remind myself what I'm trying to do with my life, trying to remind myself that I'm trying to focus on this great problem of my life. Because I'm not the Buddha, I don't have his incredible integration. I need to keep on talking about it, just remind myself what I'm doing. So I could be wiser for this evening, if only I could give to myself to it more. If only I could let go of that little winch of time and just be here just now with you and try to, as best I can, tell you what the Buddha would say if he was here. Yeah? So there's wisdom just now, and then I actually need to be positive just now. I'm not feeling very well at the moment. I'm feeling a bit rough today. But do I want to, just sort of fall into that and sort of feel sorry for myself, or do I want to try and be more positive, be more creative with my experience? Yeah? So there's positive emotion just now for me, if there needs to be, and there is for you. You could think, gosh, it's really hot and stuffy in here. Or you think, actually, no, this is interesting, I want to follow this. Let me just be here just now. Yeah? So there's positive emotion here just now. There's receptivity just now. And so on and so forth. There's the whole of our life just now, if we want to engage with it. So the main things I want to say about integration tonight is these three elements of integration. I want to talk about being ourselves. No, I don't. I want to talk wrong order. I want to talk about knowing ourselves, being ourselves, and challenging ourselves. Yeah? And all of this is a communal aspect of integration. One of the things I want to keep on reminding ourselves is that us human beings, this living thing, this challenge of our life, this problem of our life, problem in the philosophical sense, this great problem of our life, is always a communal problem as much as it is a personal problem. There isn't a you apart from your parents, for instance. It's very interesting. One of the things I notice with people practicing spiritual life, and I notice this in my own life, is that very quickly their relationships with their parents improves. Because your parents, your relationship with, not having a good relationship with your parents is like having a bad relationship with yourself. Very much of who you are just now is to do with your parents. Actually, 50% of you, who you are just now, is your genetic inheritance, not just from your parents, but from your whole line, as it were. So not to have a good relationship with your parents, however they've been, is going to affect your spiritual life. Even if your parents are dead, you can change your relationship with your parents. Like my relationship with my father has improved since he died. It has, actually. Whether his relationship with me has improved, I don't know. But mine has, perhaps because he can't talk back anymore. So this idea of me is really just an illusion. And it's a very contemporary 21st century illusion that we're extremely wedded to, so that we think that spiritual life is all about me. So integration sounds good because it's all about getting more integrated in myself, noticing my shadow areas and so forth. It includes that, but I think we get far too focused on that. It's to do with us. Yeah? It's to do with us. So we're trying to integrate us, not me. So that means integrating ourselves in relationship with other people. So these three things tonight are to do with the communal aspect of being, which is already a given. You can't choose not to have it. It's only in this modern, Western, so-called developed world that we could ever believe that we could. Sanghanath comes from a village in India. No way could he have conceived of himself as this separate, atomized individual that we do in the highly luxurious West. There's no way. You wouldn't have lived. Yeah. Sanghanath comes from a whole network of relationships which makes his life without that unthinkable. Ours is like that as well, but we don't notice it so much. We're not. And as economics change, we might have to notice it much more than we ever have. We might be suddenly having to be woken up in a way that will be very, very difficult for us because we're not used to it. Our way of living in the West is unsustainable. It will destroy, actually, let's destroy ourselves first before it will destroy the planet. But it's unsustainable. So the first aspect of this communal practice is knowing ourselves. And this is the first element of integration I want to touch upon. I won't say much about this, so I can help it. In a way, this is getting to know who we are. All these three aspects really go together. So to be integrated is to start to genuinely know yourself. It sounds slightly trivial, and it sounds a bit hackneyed, really. You know, I try to know myself, but we do need to understand that we need to divine ourselves. We need to fathom ourselves. We need to find out what kind of creature we are, and we haven't got any manual. I was talking a bit about this before. Nobody gave you a manual when you were born saying, tell you what, this is the kind of being you are. These kind of situations, actually, you're not going to be any good in that. Do it if you can, but actually you're not going to be very good at that. But you'll need this. You have to work it out. It's like you've got a manual, but you can't read it yet. And you need to learn the manual of yourself. You need to learn, I need to learn what kind of creature I am. How I flourish most. What situations I can't afford to involve myself in. There are certain things in my life that still now I think I just can't afford to think about that. I don't usefully think about it. So for instance, my parents ran a small coach firm, so I come from a small town where they had to work all the time, my family. We all did in a way, but they did particularly. They were self-employed. So I've been brought up with a very, very strong belief that yes, you can do things, but you need to work. Which I think has served me in many ways very, very well. Where it doesn't serve me very well is when I think other people aren't doing enough. Yeah. So I can get really fixated, I don't know, I'm sure I'm the only one here, but I can get really fixated on someone who I don't think is doing enough, who I don't think is pulling their weight enough. Because my childhood said that you can't do that. If you don't, I come from a family of five, we had no money, my parents are trying to run a coach business in a small town. Tell you what, you can't afford not to work. We can't live without working. So I even now easily get frustrated with people who I don't feel are working enough. But I feel when I try and think about it that I can't think about it objectively. It's loaded with my own story, too prejudicially. And if I'm not careful, I just end up with Protestantism, where, tell you what, as long as you work, it doesn't matter. So in my life, I somehow think that it doesn't matter what happens to me. In my grave, it will say, he did work hard. It's almost as if that value becomes, as long as you worked hard, the rest isn't neither here nor there. You know what I mean? Whether you were happy enough, what's that got to do with anything? Do you know what I mean? So you see that problem of that metaphor. It has meant that I've worked hard in some ways, although I'm also very lazy in other ways, but I keep it secret. which you'll find, but it's very easy to do. You can make anything into a job if you try hard enough. I just have to walk up the stairs. It's exhausting, you know. So, you see what I mean? So, I notice that I can't afford to think about that. My thinking about that is prejudiced by my Protestant upbringing and my belief in work. And that can end up meaning that it doesn't matter what mental state you've got, as long as you work hard, then you're fine. But that's not what Buddhism is teaching, see to me. So even now I notice, tell you what, remember, that you're not very objective about that situation. Yes, do talk about that and say, look, I just wonder. Check it out with your friends, because you'll need other opinions about that, yeah? Start to notice, here's where I've got a bit of a prejudice about this. Some people have got a prejudice about working hard. The opposite, you know what I mean? People who work hard, well, they just do things, they don't have any depth. I'm a person who tries to be more. And that can be a whole other story, depending, yeah? So part of knowing yourself, I wish I'd written this in my book, I have to go back to this chapter now, because much better example than I've used in the book. Part of your knowing yourself is really seeing, to see how you're patterned by your life, and to see that will show some things up, spotlight up some things, and push some things in the shade. The Dharma life, the journey, the spiritual life, is always going to be challenging that. I'll come back into that in a minute. But we need to learn that. We need to fathom ourselves. Psychologically, physically almost. Like a friend of mine, Canute, lovely guy, I don't know whether you've met an Australian friend of mine. He was in a bad mood once, and I just said, you need to submerge yourself in water. That's what you need to do. Go swimming now. And he said, that's such a good idea, that's right. Didn't sound very spiritual, but I knew immediately that's what you need to do. He's a very physical type. He always played professional cricket. And you could see that what was happening, he was trying to think his way out from it, and actually just needed to get back into his body again. Very physical, kind of sporting type. Even his thinking is kind of sporting. So what he needed to do is submerge himself in water. Then he'd be happier, then he'd be able to think. You know what I mean? And it's true, it happened, yeah. So some people are very physical types. They need to be physically active, and if you're not, you get all gummed up. I mean, everybody needs to be physically active, I think. Most of us need to be doing more exercise than we are. But some people are especially like that, aren't they? They're very sort of sporting types. Won't surprise you that I'm not. I'm an arty type, which won't surprise anybody. So, for instance, I need to make sure that all my life, I've always needed to do some what I call first level creative work. I remember one day being in this really bad mood, I thought, Maharaj Bandhi, here's your chance. Just cut something out of a magazine and stick it in a book and write something and draw a picture. It took me about 5 minutes, I felt much happier straight away. Then I could actually get on with doing something. Do you see what I mean? Now, I've always been a bit worried about that because I'm never convinced. I don't like archetypes generally, so don't try it on. And I'm never convinced of this theory, so I've always been very reluctant to believe it. But actually, I find that if I'm not doing something creative, in that art sense, I get irritable, and I start to make you my creative project. And you won't like that, folks, because I'm not very forgiving. Yeah? So that's what I mean, knowing yourself in that way. What kind of creature are you? How do you best work? How do you flourish most? You won't be able to do that all the time, but see whether your life is actually bringing the best out of you. If it's not, is there things you can change to change that? If you're an extrovert and you're living on your own, tell you what, that's not going to bring the best out of you. If you're an introvert and you're always with people, tell you what, you're going to hate that eventually. Fathom yourself. I can't do that for you. Only you can do it. But you'll need to do it in relationship with other people. It's my friends that have helped me do that. My friends have said, you know, my Parambandhu will someone say, if I'm in a bad mood, he'll say, have you been doing any writing recently? I said, no, I haven't. You must do it. Oh, yes, that's good. That's a good point. And he reminds me, because I forget. I just think, well, I don't need to do that, and I forget. Sometimes your friends can see you much better than you are. So one of the ways in which you learn to know yourself is having friends who know you. Not mates, because they won't help you at all, but friends who really know you, and they can say, oh, you need to be, you need to remember that. You need to submerge yourself in water. That's what you need to do just now. Yes, you need a bit of time on your own. Sometimes we're not very good at remembering that our friend, even our partner, needs to be alone. Some people just think, no, you can't possibly, you must need to be with me. I've got this friend who just goes, he's like a monkey, he just goes from one person to another talking. I find it absolutely, he's just so extroverted. And I just shrink more and more. And he just goes, gets more and more energy as he swings from one person to another. And he just can't understand that, no, I need to back off the tree now. You know? I need to be alone now. You know? And he can even sort of slightly think, you know, I'm just sort of cutting off and all those sort of pejorative things, which of course one can be doing. But even though I'm quite extroverted, I do need quite a lot of time alone. Yeah? So fathom yourself. That's the first thing. That's an aspect of integration, and knowing yourself. Yeah. Second aspect of integration that I want to talk about, I said I wouldn't talk very long about that one, but never mind, is being yourself. Yeah, being yourself. So it's not enough to fathom yourself, we also need to be ourselves. In the sense of, I don't think I've actually quite clarified this in my mind, that's why I'm having to have all of you people in front of me so I can. We need to be ourselves. We need to have a context in which we can be ourselves. So this is, by this I mean a communal context, so we can be ourselves. It's not enough to know yourselves. In fact, without being able to be yourself, you won't be able to know yourself. Knowing yourself is not an abstract thing. To know yourself, you have to be yourself. Sometimes it's only in being yourself you realise, oh, that's the self I am. You know what I mean? That's what I am. So sometimes on silence on retreats I think, oh, how lovely. Oh, how nice. It's silent. Oh, I need silence. You know what I mean? You don't notice it until you can be it. Yeah? So being yourself, to be yourself, we need to create a community together that encourages you to be yourself. Now, I don't mean just be yourself in the pejorative sense. I mean be yourself in this sort of healthy, happy sense. Who are you? Can you be yourself? Now, sometimes that's something that you can't be in other situations. So I mentioned last week I was gay. I hope that didn't shock anybody. I didn't see any postings about it. Everyone fainted out of shock. You know. But one of the things I came from a small town, so that was an agony for me when I was a child. I knew nobody else who was gay. The only person that was gay was Larry Grayson on the television. It was a nightmare. I'm destined to be Larry Grayson. He was actually very funny sometimes, I just couldn't see that. I had no role models, I just thought nobody else was gay. Yeah? So then I went, one of the reasons I came to London is I got involved in the gay scene in London. And yet suddenly I was surrounded by gay men mostly, and you could be gay there because everybody was. Yeah. But actually I actually felt very out of place there. I found it, in my experience, a rather trivial world, and a world that was a very, very competitive world, and I felt very out of place there. Really wasn't what I meant either. I didn't really want to be gay, like a career, you know. I remember a friend of mine saying, all my friends are gay, I go on gay holidays. Everything he did was gay. I thought it was just like mad. I wanted to say to him, were the car parks gay? I remember this gay-only hotel. I was just saying, well, the clouds are gay, are they? You know, is the seat gay? You know, it's going too far. But what I really appreciated was in this context, I could be without making a big deal of it, I seem to be at the moment, but without making a big deal of it, without needing to hide it, but without needing to live on it. You know, I just had curly hair. You know, I mean, that was all it was to it, and I didn't want to have to apologise for that because there's nothing to apologise for. Yeah. So having a communal world in which it was all right to be gay was incredibly important to me at 24. I mean, really, really important to me. Where I could be gay and more than gay. Where it wasn't a special thing, it wasn't a bad thing. Sometimes people want to make it one or the other. Yeah. So it can be just like that. You can just be yourself. It's not a problem here. There's no problem about it psychologically, metaphysically, ethically. There isn't a problem. You know, it's just the world has made it into a problem. And there are all sorts of things in life that the world has made a problem that isn't a problem. And we need a community that doesn't make things that aren't a problem. Life's bad enough. We've got a really, really big problem. So let's not create any more, eh? We've got a humongous problem here. So we don't need any more of them. Yeah? You can think of your own other examples of that. Yeah. But so in so many different ways, we need to be able to be ourselves, don't we? And that means being among people where we can be honest, for instance. I think that one of the dangers for people, particularly men, is having mates. You end up with these mates who you do that joshing thing, you do that slapping on the back thing, you do that getting drunk thing, you do that, hey, go, thing. But nobody actually says anything honest. Nobody actually takes any emotional risks. I think machismo often is, in men, is often to do with emotional cowardice, actually. So you can't take emotional risks, so you have to sort of look tough, because you're not emotionally very strong. So we need situations in which we can just be honest. In a strange way, we also need situations in which we can be positive. We can be actually sincere. We can talk about serious things. When I was younger, I was really frustrated with a world in which I could never talk seriously. I found it really irritating. I thought when I grew up, I'd get to talk about serious things. The problem of life, the philosophical problems, the nature of perception, all those wonderful philosophical problems. Ooh, they're so fascinating. I remember once, when Jan Hirsch first got involved, we went to this coffee and we had this whole conversation about Kant and Schopenhauer. I mean, I knew about five things, and I exhausted them before we got to the cafe. Luckily, we both read the same book. So, and then we were trying to think about the nature of perception, and is there more than... they're fascinating. I hope that that's the kind of life I would lead as I grow up. But so often in the situations we create, we can't have a serious conversation. We can't talk about important things. Or if we do, we have to sort of ping back into silly jokes. Like this conspiracy of charm. We have to keep on saying, don't worry folks, I'm not going to be serious. I'm not going to be whatever. I'm just going to have a laugh. On the other hand, of course, I've been in situations where everybody is either doing a how much personal trauma have you had competition, which is like a trauma fest, which is, oh, come on. Or everyone's so keen to be earnest, nobody's allowed to have a laugh. You know what I mean? Sometimes you want a situation where you can just have a laugh. I mean, when I first started writing poetry, I went to this poetry workshop. I was on this table, I was surrounded by all these earnest faces. And I thought, oh, not again. I've had enough of this at the Buddhist Centre. The last thing I needed, frankly, was another room full of earnest faces. Any situation creates a kind of, here's how you behave. Yeah? So to be yourself, in your heights and depths, to be able to say, actually, I'm not very good at this. Actually, like I was talking to a friend of mine, I was trying to say, you really do need to say, look, I'm really sorry, but I'm really not good at this interaction thing. I can see you're angry with me, but I've no idea why. I mean, he really just has no idea why. He just doesn't pick it up. He doesn't notice it early enough, and then he gets upset, and he gets very embattled. And I'm saying, you're not picking it up. I can see it a mile off. You're not picking it up. You need to start to say, look, I can see you're a bit angry with me. Can you explain to me what you think is happening? Because I don't get it, actually. That's he's a long way away from that just now, yeah? However you do it, how are you going to be yourself more? That's an essential aspect of integration. To have that, you need a community, and to have that, you need friends. You can't do that on your own. You just can't, yeah? You need people around you can be yourself with, and you need especially people that you look up to who will help you be yourself, who will be able to even point things out to you. And this is the last part of my seminar, this is my third thing, which you need to challenge yourself. There's no growth without challenge. There's no integration without challenge. all of us have a very coherent and believable story about the kind of person we are, don't we? We can all tell the story of our life, so we end up with a very just, self-justified, believable story about why I'm like this. If you're not careful, you get in a bad mood and you can tell all the reasons why you have to be in a bad mood just now. Or in my life, my story of my life was one of being a victim. You know, I was bullied by my brothers, blah, 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 blah. So when I first came along here, I had a very polished story about why I was a victim, why people are horrible to me and so on, yeah? What I discovered here was not only that I could be myself and know myself, but where people would challenge my stories. I had friends who would actually say, eventually, tell you what, I don't think this story is quite accurate and I don't think it's very helpful. Yeah? Because what it would do is my story about being a victim would mean that I would edit my story. We're always editing the story of our life. So I, for instance, not mention the time where I was rather unpleasant when I was young, when I would victimise people when I was young. I would edit those out of my story and tell the story about when I was victimised. I then want to add in my sort of edit my story to say that you were aggressive, not me, yeah? And not admit to how much aggression there was in me, because in my aggression was much more subterranean, yeah? Or whatever it is. Yeah? So we need our stories about ourselves need to be challenged so that we can become integrated, so we can know ourselves and be ourselves. We're often nowhere near as nice as we'd like to believe. We're often nowhere near as bad as we'd like to believe either. This is what was Sangrachta, our founder of the movement, once said of himself. He said, I'm much better than people think I am, and much worse than people think I am. Yeah? And this is true of all of us. We're much better than people think we are, and we're much worse. And we need a context in which we can know ourselves, and be ourselves, and have ourselves actually challenged. Especially in friendship, it won't work unless you've got friends, because you'll defend yourself against it too much. You need someone, I need someone, who has my own best interests at heart, and who's willing to say, you've got a blind spot here. You know, you'll keep on talking about how bad your boss is, you know, and I can see that she's like this and she's like that, but I think you're doing something here as well, and I don't think you're very good at seeing it yet. That's what a good friend will do. Just see how I think you're not seeing yourself here. How part of the issue with our life is that we've got inevitable blind spots. It's very difficult to see ourselves from inside ourselves. We need other people to feed us back. That means we need friends. That means we need a whole community, doesn't it? So those are the three areas of integration I want to talk about tonight. I've talked about, first of all, moving from the metaphor of the journey to the metaphor of the mandala, which means cultivating these five stages of spiritual life all the time. We're trying to do all of them. We can never really separate them. It's only a way of talking. It's only a way of seeing. And how I'm saying that we can do it this week is we do it from this communal point of view. We do it in terms of knowing ourselves, being ourselves, and allowing ourselves to be challenged. Checking out our stories of ourselves with our close friends. So what I want to recommend as our home practice this week is that we do some reflection on ourselves. So either, say a friend of yours or a few friends, why don't you organise a time where you get together and tell your life stories? One of the things, that's the reason why I thought we'd start as we did, because one of the things that can help us know ourselves is just tell the story of our life to other people. So just want you a few friends together and tell your life story. Just you have half an hour each or whatever it is. Or just write about your life story. Write about three turning points in your life is another way of doing it. What has been the three sort of major turning points of your life? And try and feel that through. That's been my life, yeah? Because I've not left that behind. Because we're now in a mandala, we're not in a journey. So on that mandala of our life, those three great events are still having their effect, just as my life in Henley Arden is still here just now. Yeah? So you might want to write about it, you might talk about it to your friend. Collect your life. Eventually we'll need to become the genius of our life. That's what enlightenment is, really, is becoming the genius of our life, the genius of life even. But there's no life, isn't it? It's always ours. It's always this life we uniquely experience. Yeah? So that's what I'm suggesting, that we practice as home practice, that we reflect on our life. We bring to mind the story of our life. We challenge the story of our life. We find ways of being ourselves. So let's just finish by doing a short breathing space, just to collect ourselves at the end of this practice. So when you're ready, closing your eyes, and see if you can notice where you've been left just now with those words. All your life is present just now. So noticing how you feel just now. And the place to look is around the heart area. And then just gathering your awareness by just tuning into your breath, your breathing body. And then extending your awareness to include your whole body. That's all we've got time for tonight. So, in a moment, if you can put your cushions and mats back in the corner along the wall. I've got somebody handing out some handouts at the end as you go out. It's quite a rough and ready thing that I'm doing at the end of the second chapter, where I just go through the forces of integration and the forces of disintegration. Yeah, just to pray, see what we've done the last 2 weeks. And we'll stay in silence in here, and then I'll see you next week.